Game over, man. Why don't you put her in charge?
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Narrative First Podcast, the weekly podcast where story is always king. I'm your host, Jim Hull, the voice of Narrative First, and this is episode 54, The Same Story, Aliens in Blade Runner 2049. Welcome back, everyone. Hope you had a great week of writing. Time for some story structure and story analysis. This week, I have a couple questions to get through, an analysis of A Bronx Tale, and then the similarities between Aliens and Blade Runner 2049. The first question is about the signpost as inequities. I think it was last week's podcast, or maybe the podcast before, I was talking about how not to use the dramatic story points as storytelling, you know, where it's like, oh, if so-and-so has a fear of water snakes, then if I just write, you know, Bob has a fear of water snakes, and that makes him really nervous, and he's not sure if he's going to be able to cross the river. That's not actually how you use dramatic story points to help you write a story, because what you're doing is you're taking the point of view of the character as if it's their fear. It's pointing out, well, I'm worried about this, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to cross the river, or whatever it is that they're afraid of doing. The dramatic story points actually are looking at the entire story all at once. So they're actually looking at the entire conflict as if it's already happened. So if you've heard me mention before, they're not about what if, they're about what is. Like, what's the actual conflict that is there that's actually tangible, that you can actually point to and go, okay, this is an actual problem. So it would be, you know, when you're actually going through and encoding and kind of illustrating the story points, maybe before you actually start writing, you would imagine, okay, well, he has this fear of water snakes, and, you know, maybe that he has such a fear of water snakes that it makes him wet the bed when he's, you know, out cavorting with others. And, you know, that's something he doesn't want to do, but it's the fear of water snakes, anything that reminds him of a water snake, he actually starts wetting the bed. And so, you know, that would be an actual encoding of a main character through line of mind, of them having this, like, intense fear. And then that's where that conflict comes from. You actually encode something that actually happens. So it's not the buildup to it, that's the backstory, and it's not like, oh, I wonder if maybe this is going to happen, will he be able to do this or not? Whenever anybody starts the Dramatica Mentorship Program, the first couple weeks, actually not the first couple weeks, but the first couple rounds are a bit frustrating because I have to work every single writer, I've yet to find one who isn't like this, I have to work them to seeing their story from the other side, from the other perspective, from the story form, because they're so used to building in tension and building in audience expectation or playing against it and all that stuff, which is great. That's why they're writers and that's why they love doing it. But if you want to use Dramatica to kind of actually figure out what it is that is in your story and what it is that you want to fix, you know, find out where the actual conflict is, then you have to stop thinking of it as this potential for conflict, as something that might be a problem for him, and he's just not sure and he's struggling. Like, that encoding doesn't work. Like, he's struggling because he has a fear. So, well, okay, so he could struggle for the next 45 days, 45 years, and nothing would ever change. There's no real inequity. It's like, oh, fine, he's struggling, who cares? You actually have to encode something that creates an actual a problem. You know, the difference between inequity and problem, and an inequity is the separateness. It's the sense that two things are separate. You know, if you think of trying to get to a point of Zen or a moment of Zen, you have no equity, right? You get rid of all kind of separateness. You're one with the universe. So that doesn't really make a great story. When you separate out and you feel that inequity, and we finally feel the separateness between us and the universe, now there's a difference. We see the difference there. And now it's, okay, well, how are we going to address it? Because we can't just sit there and just let the inequity fester. We have to do something with it. And so what we do is we pick one side and we make that, you know, the thing that we're not going to reconsider. Like, well, okay, that's always going to be that way. And then the other side becomes a problem. So problems are not inequities. Problems are stuff we make up in our head to deal with inequities. And then we build up on top of those problems all kinds of justifications, and you build up like four levels of justification, And now you have a character that's ready to be a change character in a story. And then each act is about them tearing away those different justifications so they can go back to see like, oh, this never was really a problem. It's actually an inequity. And now am I going to keep doing things the way that I always have done? Or am I going to change to this other person who's been bugging me this whole time and try and see, you know, deal with it the way that they're dealing with it? And that's what a story is. It's actually, it's taking a single inequity, looking at it from all four perspectives, and then coming up with a single approach to resolving that problem, and then letting you know whether or not that was a success or failure, or if it was a good thing or a bad thing. So when you actually go to encode the story points, it's important to actually encode them as actual, like, define why it's a problem. Like, why, what is the actual problem, and why is that an issue for them? And I use issue and problem and concern and through line all mixed into one because they all really are describing that inequity. They just ratchet the magnification up depending on what level you're at. But when it comes to the signposts, signpost 1, 2, 3, and 4, those aren't storytelling devices. It's not like, oh, okay, well, the group of characters, the group of fighters are understanding that there's a new boss in town. And then the group of characters learn that somebody in their group got hurt. And then the group of characters chase after the bad guy, and then the group of characters defeat the bad guy. Okay, that would be understanding, learning, doing, obtaining. And that's like nothing. That does absolutely nothing. It's the same thing as like just saying, oh, Bob fears water snakes, and so he struggles. You can't really do anything with that. And it's I guess it's fine if you're just using them as writing prompts, but you're really not in any better position than you were without Dramatica, and you're not in any better position than you would be if you just picked up a dictionary, flipped through a random page, and just pointed with your eyes closed and said, okay, this is what my story is. So you can do that. That's awesome. But if you want to actually use Dramatica to increase the effectiveness of your storytelling and make a really solid, concrete story, then you're going to want to use the signpost, not as just simply a storytelling writing prompt, but as an actual contextual umbrella for everything that happens underneath. So it's like the problem, if there is a problem of desire, an issue of instinct, a concern of understanding, and a through line of physics, which just so happens to be the overall story through line for the subject of the article this week. If you have that, then the first signpost of understanding is a contextual umbrella for those things. So it's looking at desire and instinct and understanding under the guise of understanding, okay? It's understanding under understanding. And then when you switch to the second signpost, now you're looking at understanding under the context of learning. And so the point of the signpost is to give an opportunity, just in the same way that you're looking at the inequity from four different perspectives, like the main character, influence character, relationship story, and overall story. The point of the signpost is to again give you those four contexts for where possibly the problem could be. So you're going to look at it in a context of understanding, then a context of learning, then a context of doing, and then finally a context of obtaining. And by that time, you've addressed where the problem could possibly be. You've looked in every single corner. And in the same way that the four perspectives give you a complete story, the four signposts give that feeling of completeness of exploration, right? Because the types are the plot. So, you know, signposts, journeys, that gives you the idea of progression, of actually moving through something, an adventure. And so once you've explored everything, that's why it feels like the story has to come to an end. Because if you go back to understanding, it's another story. It's like, well, I've already dealt with understanding. Why would I want to deal with it again? So each of those signposts is an actual, think of it as like an umbrella that contains everything underneath. Now, you don't necessarily have to, you could be obsessive about it and go through and make sure everything is exactly to, you know, okay, now I have to think of desire and understanding. What does that mean? And you could spend forever doing that. I'm saying more just like in a general sense, kind of bridge the gap between just using it as storytelling, like Bob understands, or the group understands that there's aliens on the planet. And okay, that does nothing. Bridge the gap between that and, okay, all these desires and under the context of understanding, how's that going to work out? Use it as a way of kind of coloring the different illustrations and different encodings so that you can explore the actual problem from all four different contexts? So I responded to that question, and then I received back, I thought every signpost was like a major event. No. The idea, that the way it's presented in the theory book where it's signpost journeys, doesn't quite fit right. It doesn't feel right. It's like, you think, oh, I have 28 magic scenes. Okay, that's what I'm supposed to do. At the time, I think that's what they thought would be the best way to present it. But the signposts are the entire act. You look at it, if you wanted to use, you know, in the old days, I don't even know how long scripts are, but let's say the scripts are 120 pages, which I think is like, you're not supposed to do that anymore. If you divided those into four, you would have every 30 pages. Okay. So, and you would, I'm sure if you've read any screenwriting books, they tell you page 26 or page 30, page 52, 26, 52, 78, and 104. Is that right? So there's 26 pages for each act. Let's just say that's what it is. So those 26 pages, that's all the first page 1 to 26, that's the understanding act. So pages 1 through 26, that's all about understanding in the overall story through line, right? You still have three other perspectives that you have to deal with. So it's not just one event. Like, they understand the aliens are there, and you could get that done in a couple sentences and you're done with it. It doesn't really work that way. It's the context of the entire act. So 1 through 26 would be signpost 1's understanding. 27 to 52 would be signpost 2, and that would all be about learning. And then there would be some major event, something that happens, you know, right in the middle that resets everything. And now all of a sudden, 53 to 78 is all about doing. And then the last 26 pages are all about obtaining. And yes, I know this is just a very mechanical, it doesn't have to hit exactly on that, but let's just say everything was exactly the same length. The signposts describe the entire act. Now, when I work with writers, doing the deliberate storytelling where I actually sit down with them and go through and actually plan out their entire story, I tend to just focus on the overall story because that's usually what most people are interested in. That's what they actually are working on. And I'll use a combination of the signposts and the plot sequences to build out the different set pieces or sequences that happen within that act. And then the other three perspectives, the main character, influence character, and relationship story, often end up just taking their own sequence. And if you follow that approach, you usually end up with about 6 to 7 sequences, or I would say story beats, for per act, which gets you anywhere from about 28 to 32 story beats, which is pretty typical for a screenplay. You do those 6 to 7, and then you also, the story driver sometimes gets its own sequence. I found that rhythm feels really nice. So in that respect, it's not like the signposts are just one event, but perhaps that story beat could be considered an event. But you also want to carry in everything that happens in that. I had no idea this is what I'm going to be talking about, but this is really cool. It's not like it's isolated in that sequence and you can't deal with it. You want to kind of weave it into the other sequences if it's just a like overall story sequence and your main character's in there and they have a certain perspective. You'll start to see in the beginning, they'll be very disparate. Like, they'll be kind of really separate, the connections between them. And then as you get closer and closer and closer to the end, by the time you get to the fourth signpost, they're so woven so tightly together and you'll see all the connections between them, that you have what Melanie used to call multi-appreciation moments, MAMs, where you have a sequence that has every single thing happening all at once. I remember when I was working with Brian Davis, who's a Dramatica story expert, but he should be. We were talking about the trench scene of Star Wars and how he was asking me all the different story points, and I ended up, and I never thought of it this way, but every single through line and every single perspective is all there just in that trench scene. You got the overall story, you got the main character, you have the influence character, he comes in, the relationship story, like everything is all, if you were to sit there and tag that entire scene, you would find it all in there. And I know when I've gone through and color coded the different sequences, what happens is in the very beginning, you have very separate, you can see isolated colors, And then once you get down to the last signpost, they're really all blended together, and it's like a virtual rainbow of storytelling. That's the name of the podcast. The virtual rainbow of storytelling. All that to say, there isn't one mechanical way, but to think of the signpost as like a single event is not the correct way to think about it. You want to think of it as a contextual umbrella for the entire act, for that entire signpost from the very beginning of it to the very end of it, and then you switch context and move to the next signpost. There is nothing more frustrating than forgetting to hit the record button and then having the window that's supposedly recording what you just spoke about for the last 10 minutes, realizing that it hasn't been running. So here I go again. Here I go again. Okay, the next question is about differentiating the past from memory. This is so deja vu. Okay, let's see if I can get through this. Differentiating the past from memory. And as I just said 10 minutes ago, if you look at the Dramatica table of story elements, the past is to memory, like they're both in the same location. One is external and one is internal. And the question came up in the Discuss Dramatica forums, well, if I have a main character concern in past, how am I able to actually deal with that without it slipping into memory? Because obviously, if it's something in the past, the character is going to be remembering it. So how is it even possible to do that? And while there were some really great answers, the real answer, and I just mean like that the best answer to address that problem, is to stop thinking of the characters in your story, at least the subjective characters, actually all the characters, as real people with real thoughts and real ideas, and actually seeing them as just perspectives on that single inequity. You know, when you go to actually write the story and you actually want to put some, obviously then you want to think of all the stuff that makes them real and give them traits and qualities that the audience can relate to, and then that brings them into the story, all that stuff. That's great. Most writers usually have that down. When you're looking at stuff, your story from a Dramatica point of view, you need to get rid of all that stuff and stop thinking of the characters as real people and actually think of them as perspective. So it doesn't mean, you know, the main character concern of the past isn't about what the character sees about the past, but rather what the story itself sees about the past. It's identifying something problematic in the past that's creating personal conflict for them. It's not about the actual remembering of it. You know, it's not like, oh, I guess I don't remember being shot and I remember that I'm actually dead, you know, in The Sixth Sense, or, you know, well, you can be my John Jay or John G in Memento, where it's like I've got this memory problem, or the actual process of remembering is creating conflict. The inequity is seen as creating conflict there. Here, it's actually something about the past, something problematic in the past that's creating conflict. It's just coming up now from that point of view, and it's something that can't be changed. You know, it's like referring to aliens and Blade Runner, which are the topic of discussion here. Both of them have a main character concern of the past. So for Ripley in Aliens, if you haven't seen the director's cut version, or if you've read the script, which everybody, you know, knows that that's like a tremendous script, there was a whole section of all the main character through line stuff pretty much got cut for the original film, where she's dealing with the fact that she essentially slept through her daughter's entire life. You know, it's like because she was frozen in space from the first movie, and she comes back and her daughter's already dead. So she missed all that. And there's nothing she can do to change about it. It's not like she has trouble remembering it. The story's not talking about that. It's talking about the fact that there's something that happened in the past that you can't change, and there's nothing you could do about it. Same thing with Blade Runner. And usually, the main character concern of past, that usually comes up in the form of some kind of guilt. So for Ripley, you know, she feels a tremendous amount of guilt that she wasn't there for her daughter. And obviously that motivates all kinds of relationships and interactions with Newt, because there's nothing she could do about it. You know, it's just something that happened, and she can't do anything about it. Same thing with Dom, the Leo DiCaprio character in Inception. He feels a tremendous amount of guilt for what he did to his wife way back when, and now she won't leave him alone about it. You know, he actually incepted something within her, and that drove her to commit suicide. And now he just feels so much guilt for what he did, and, you know, wishes he could change it, but he can't. Like, that past is coming back to haunt him. So both in Inception and in Aliens, you get the idea that, okay, well, here's something in the past that's creating a tremendous amount of guilt. And that's where you're going to get the emotional part of it. It's not the fact that they're remembering and that's some kind of issue. It's the fact that it can't be changed. When it comes to Blade Runner 2049, it's the same thing. He can't change something in the past. Somebody in his past, way back when, set the course of events to put something in motion that he really has no control of, but he's obviously a major part of. That there's no guilt there, but it's the same thing as the first two films, where you're looking at something problematic in the past that's creating personal conflict for them during the course of the story. So in all these things, you know, the very best thing you can do, if you start thinking of these different through lines and the different story points, if you think of the through lines as different perspectives and not characters, then it's easier for you to find the kind of problem that will fit best with your story. So all this to say, if you can start thinking of the characters as perspectives instead of actual characters themselves, then you'll be able to identify how a main character concern of the past works. You'll be able to see it as something that just happens, or something that happened in their past that they're having to deal with now. And you'll be able to get away from the sort of the emotional trappings that come with thinking subjectively of your characters when it comes to actually writing your story. Eventually you'll have to do that, but when you're doing dramatic work, you want to kind of pull away from that. So the moment you can start thinking of the through lines as perspectives instead of actual characters, the easier it'll be for you to find the kind of problems that will fit best with your story. Next up, Robert McKee and Story Points. Let me just make sure I'm recording here. Okay, so this is fun. This was a really great observation that I got to see over the weekend. Somebody wrote in and asked about McKee's idea that all the characters essentially rotate around the protagonist, which he's thinking of the main character, but all the different characters are like planets rotating around the sun, and they all just basically reflect different traits of the protagonists and gives him different ways of looking at things so that he can get to the end. I always thought that was really awesome when I first heard it way back when, and I know now why I thought it was awesome. It's not completely 100% accurate, but the idea that it's not really, you know, these people that are in the story aren't a bunch of just random characters that are just all over the place doing their own things that are really fun and entertaining, that they actually work to kind of work towards a greater singular meaning, which obviously was Dramatica, obviously was something that Dramatica pointed out. That idea really excited me. And when this question was posed on the forums, I thought it was a great opportunity to kind of parse that out and to see exactly what McKee was getting at. Let's see. I'll read a little bit of it, and I'll do it in my Robert McKee voice. In essence, the protagonist creates the rest of the cast. All other characters... Wait, I don't know if that's him. Let me try again. Okay. In essence, the protagonist creates the rest of the cast. All other characters are in a story first and foremost because of the relationship they strike to the protagonist and the way each helps to delineate the dimensions of the protagonist's complex nature. Imagine a cast as a kind of solar system with the protagonist as the sun, supporting roles as planets around the sun, bit players as satellites around the planets, all held in orbit by the gravitational pull of the star at the center, each pulling at the tides of the other's natures. Okay. Jeez, that's a mouthful. But it's a really cool idea, right? They are what they are principally to... What? They are what they are principally to make clear and believable, through action and reaction, the complexity of the central role. All right. Excuse me. So that's a really cool idea. But what is he actually seeing? What he's actually referring to is the relationship of the objective story elements to the goal of the story. So you, the overall story through line perspective, which is looking at that single inequity from the overall story perspective, actually sees different character elements, motivations, methodologies, evaluations, and purposes. They're all in context, not of the actual protagonist, but of the goal of the overall story, because the protagonist doesn't matter. He's just another force in relation to the goal. The goal is the important part because the inequity, you know, the central inequity that kicks things off, the story goal is the efforts to resolve that inequity. And so those characters stand in relation to how are we actually going to resolve that inequity. Now, if you're going to blend main character and protagonist together, then obviously you're going to start seeing cross-chatter and you're going to say, oh, they're in relation to the quote-unquote protagonist of the story. But beyond being reductive, it's not completely accurate because then you start to get caught up with the main character's personal issues. And then now all of a sudden, objective character elements, which are supposed to be in relation to the overall story goal, now suddenly are informing the main character's personal issues. And it's just inaccurate because it just simply doesn't work with the same issues. They're actually looking at the inequity from two completely different points of view, and they don't connect. I mean, there'll be some harmonizing between the two of them, but they don't actually really connect that way. So what he's doing is he's assuming, you know, because he blends protagonists and main characters, he's assuming that they're in relation to him, but really they're in relation to the story goal. So if you have a goal of understanding, like you do in Aliens and Blade Runner 2049, then who represents the force of pursuit and who represents the force of prevention, of avoidance? So avoidance obviously are all the alien hive. The pursuit, the protagonist part, is it Ripley? It's either Ripley or it's, it's Ripley. Like they got to go figure out and she's kind of leading the charge on that, right? And then of course you have Hicks, who's the complete skeptic. Game over, man. Game over, man. Why don't you put her in charge? Right? So he's the disbelieving opposing guy. Actually, no, he's not disbelieving opposing. He's disbelief and he's emotion. No, he's pretty much emotion, right? Actually, I think that's what he is. He's the emotion guy, if I remember correctly. Uncontrolled and feeling. That's totally him. And that's not in relation to Ripley. That has nothing to do with her at all. It's in relation to the goal. Like, okay, when it comes to trying to understand what happened here on LV-426, the person that represents feeling and uncontrolled, those emotions, not those emotions, the elements of feeling and uncontrolled don't necessarily contribute to a positive growth towards understanding of actually reaching that goal. So it's not the uncontrolled and the feeling is not in relation to Ripley and her guilt about over what she, you know, what she went through. Obviously, her pursuit and consider, right? You know, she's the one that's, as she is the protagonist, she's the one that's getting everybody to consider what actually happened, you know, with what she went through before. That's separate from what she's actually dealing with personally inside her own head. And so Hicks really doesn't, he doesn't mess with that. He doesn't really impact that in the way that McKee describes. So there you can see, I mean, he's got the beginnings of understanding of what actually is going on with these different characters, but his conclusion is not as accurate as it is if you look at it from a Dramatica point of view, if you look at it from the idea of the story form and that this is a model of a single human mind trying to solve a problem. So a more comprehensive understanding of narrative actually looks for that initial inequity, you know, what actually set things off. And here it's like when they lost, in Aliens, it's when they lost communication with the colony. And in Blade Runner, I believe it's when the discovery of the replicant baby. And then there's a goal to resolve that inequity. In both films, it's understanding, you know, what understanding what actually is going on here. And then assigns those different objective character elements in context of that goal to the individual players. It's not assigned to the main character. It's not assigned to the central character of the story. It'll appear that way if they're the protagonist, but really what it is you're assigning it in context of the goal of the story. I said I would try and keep these short. I was trying to keep them under 30 minutes, and I simply can't do it. But I will blow through my analysis of a Bronx Tale because you can read about it all online. I was not a huge fan of the movie. I mean, I'm not a huge fan, but I've never seen it until a couple of years ago and watched it. And just so happens to be Summer's, like, one of her favorite movies. And I watched it and I was like, it's okay. Maybe it's a tale. I mean, it was all right. It was really hard for me to, I got super bored in a lot of spots, but I liked being able to recognize quotes that I've heard other people say, you know, he's out of your life for $20. Like that kind of stuff. It's like, oh, I see where that comes from now. That kind of stuff was great. And it wasn't until this last weekend that it occurred to me like, oh, this has a huge, really different and positive story form to it. And there's a reason why I had so much trouble getting attached to it. In the off season, on the weekends, I'm busy building something for everybody that I'm sure you'll love. And I was sitting on the couch working on that while Summer put on A Bronx Tale and wanted to watch it again. I was like, all right, well, here we go again. And my daughter, who, you know, she's a teenager, so she really doesn't want to watch movies with me anymore. She won't. We watched Doctor Who, but that was when she was young and actually liked hanging out with me. Now she doesn't. Anyways, so she was in the kitchen and kind of watching it from afar, and she just got caught up in it. Like within 10, 15 minutes, she's like, oh. And she went and sat down on the couch and actually watched the entire film with us, which she never does. And that's when I was like, oh, the main character in the story, he's a holistic problem solver. You know, the reason why I had so much trouble, not analyzing it, but being into it the first time, is because the guy in the story, I forget his name. Oh, what's the guy's name? The kid's name is, oh yeah, right. Caligero, what they call him, C. The reason why I had so much trouble attaching myself to the story is because he's a holistic problem solver. He has a female mental sex. And if you know anything about mental sex from the dramatic point of view, the mental sex of the main character sets the operating system of the story, whether or not they're going to solve problems linearly or holistically. And solving problems linearly is quite simple. It's just like I go from A to B and I solve this problem, then I solve this problem, and then I'm done. And for something like Aliens or Blade Runner 2049, that's super obvious. It's like, okay, yeah, they're both linear. In fact, Ryan Gosling's character is an investigator and he's just following one clue after the other. So it's like, okay, well, he's making the connections that way. A holistic problem solver doesn't see things that way. The holistic problem solver sees all the relationship between things. You know, when we do the user group meetings, we start at the top and then we progressively break things down into smaller and smaller squares. Holistic thinkers get super annoyed and really bored by the time we get halfway through, because to them, it's like, I just want to see the entire table of story elements. And I just want to grab the one that speaks to me because I can see all the relationships between things. So give me the whole relationship all at once and I'll tell you where the problem is. I'll be able to help you explain your story. So it's really hard for linear thinkers to empathize or get into the mindset of a holistic thinker because it just doesn't make any sense. It's like, why would you even do that? Like my favorite example is the Ewan McGregor character from Moulin Rouge, where he just like bursts out in song. That's how he reverses the balance of things. Like there's tension in a linear thinker would either punch his way out or find some way to get out of there. The holistic thinker resets the balance of the relationships in the room. And so he just starts singing. And it's like, why the heck would you even do that? So when it's hard, if you're a predominantly linear thinker and you're having trouble attaching yourselves to a narrative, that's usually the source of problem there, is because the main character is a holistic problem solver. And once my daughter sat down and she actually once she was there like 30 or 45 minutes and she wasn't going anywhere and I could tell her setting in, I started to think, okay, there must be something here. And a funny thing happened as I was coding and building other stuff. Out of the corner of my ear, the fact that I wasn't focusing completely on the narrative itself, the story form was like super obvious. Because I wasn't caught up in the storytelling, the music and the acting and what was actually going on, I was just kind of hearing it while I was doing something else. The story form was super obvious. And I almost feel like that would be a great way to analyze films if you're having trouble, or if, I mean, I'm not sure what you would do if you're writing your own story, if you have somebody read it to you and you don't pay attention to them while you do something else. I guess that kind of works. If you are working on something else, like I was over the weekend, it comes right through. And there were obvious things about trust and testing. I mean, there's a lot of influence character focusing on the problems of trust, where it's just like, you know, you can't trust anybody. So I'm going to test every single person that comes into my line of sight. And, you know, it stood out to me, the overall story. Again, it's not in the external domain, it's in the internal domain. So when it comes to stuff like, you know, where the actual conflict is coming from, the pre-conscious just pops up. It's like, that's where the actual problem is. And it's almost like a Romeo and Juliet story. Actually, I just made that connection too. I think that is the same. I think the overall story in Romeo and Juliet is pre-conscious, isn't it? No, that's not true. I know it's there, but it's not. No, it's not. It's in physics. Okay, that doesn't work. And then you get a main character who has this kind of, it's really interesting because his problems aren't very problematic. It's more that he creates problems for himself because he has this enlightened point of view. You know, he's willing to date someone of a different color because that's just, there's nothing wrong with that. And he's been raised to think differently, or he's just this kind of different person. And so it's not stuff that's beset upon him that he has to deal with or whatever. It's kind of like a positive problem. It's shown to be enlightenment. The issue of enlightenment is shown to be a positive thing, where it gets him into trouble, obviously, but it's not looking at it from the negative. You know, like if there was a story issue of self-interest where it's like everybody's selfish, usually you do that. It was just nice to see what happens. I believe Iron Giant's the same way, where the kid is just, he comes from an enlightened point of view, and that helps influence and change the people around him. I mean, he changes in A Bronx Tale, he changes both his dad and Chaz Palminteri. Like, they both work as influence characters, and they both have their own moments where they change. And it's great because the influence character resolve change moment always, always, always happens off screen, right? Because you're not with the influence character. And so when the car stops and Chaz opens up the door and says, "Get out of the car," that is the influence character resolve of change. And he did that off screen. We weren't there with him. So if you get a chance, check out the analysis of A Bronx Tale. I'll put that up there. It's great because it's such a different story form than what we're used to. And it just adds to the whole panoply. Is that a word? Panoply? It just adds to the whole spectrum of story forms that we have available that you can compare and contrast against with your own story. And now on to the final part, which is the same story, which I think would be a cool series, and just compare how different narratives have the same, or different films have the same narrative, but they're completely different stories. And I'm not, so this one is going to be the same story, Aliens and Blade Runner 2049. Now, I'm not talking about the idea where every story is the same story, and there's always a refusal of a call, and they get the sword in the belly of the beast, and they return with the elixir, and they're transformed, and they are, you know, Christ-like. That's not what I'm talking about. That blahooey is just not very productive, because the same people who think that think Star Wars and The Matrix are the same exact story, and they're completely different story forms. You know, Luke does not have a problem with faith, and Neo does not have a problem with trusting. They're completely different. They sound the same to people who don't know the difference between faith and trust, but there is a significant difference in the kind of issues that they deal with. It's a completely different story. So I'm not talking about that kind of stuff. What I'm talking about is the actual story form. There are a handful, maybe there's like 20 different occurrences of this, where different, completely different narratives have the same exact story form. The classic example is Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story. They have the same exact story, and obviously everybody's like, well, this is Romeo and Juliet, but set in modern day when it first came out. The only difference is the limit, the story limit. I believe West Side Story has a 6-week time lock on it, whereas Romeo and Juliet has the classic option lock because Shakespeare knew what he was doing. But beyond that, they're the same exact story. And I know this will be a fun series. I know Finding Nemo and Collateral, the Jamie Foxx, Tom Cruise thriller, those are the same exact story form. So yeah, this would actually be kind of fun. So when I finally discovered the most accurate story form for Blade Runner last week, it occurred to me that this is the same exact story form as Aliens. And of course, I have a lot of familiarity with it because I was currently writing a screenplay with it. And I loved the connection between the main character's problem and the overall story problem in both stories. In both stories, the problem is desire. So the element of desire and the solution in both the main character and overall story through lines is ability. So when it comes to, let's just say, the overall story through line of Aliens, there is this desire or this drive, this wanting to survive, to exist. The aliens have a desire to live, and they don't want to be bothered. This is where we live. This is what we're going to do. And issues of instinct come up, instinct of survival. And you can see that reflected in Blade Runner 2049 with all the replicants. They have a wanting and a desire to rise up and to be, you know, fulfill their original programming and to be something more. And that instinct for survival of being treated like, you know, not a slave as a human, that is driving all the conflict in the story. So there you have the same desire problem in both overall story through lines for both films. Now, when you go to look at the main character through line, you get to see that same problem, but from a different point of view. So again, the central inequity of a story is there, and the perspectives are looking at that single inequity and providing a single approach to resolving that inequity. And it just so happens Blade Runner 2049 and Aliens are promoting or arguing for the same approach. Both of them end in success. Good. When you have a changed main character, its connection with the overall story is that it shares the same problem and solution as the overall story. So here, Ripley, she is driven by a desire, a lack, like she wants so badly to, she wishes so badly that she could have been there for her daughter, and that's something that could never be satisfied, could never be fulfilled. And that drives her inside. If you've seen the actual director's cut, you can see those moments when she deals with those personal issues regarding her daughter. I mean, they were essential to the story. I understand why you took them out, probably for pacing or whatever, but they inform the story that that's what she's dealing with. And in Blade Runner, Kay, which is the Ryan Gosling replicant, you know, he has this overwhelming desire to be loved. Like he just wants that. I mean, I've read lots of different articles about how it's the motherly love and how he wants to have that feeling, regardless of where it's coming from. Obviously, he has this want and this desire. And just a real short thing about wants and needs, everybody would be like, well, they all have wants and needs. This story is actually depicting the problem with wants. You know, actually wanting something is a problem. And it's actually motivating and driving the narrative forward. So you have both those characters are being driven by that, and you can see how that's a reflection of what's going on in the overall story. It's from a very personal point of view. You get to see what that looks like, you know, dealing with those kind of wants and desires personally, but you also get to see it on a larger scale with what everybody else is dealing with, and it gives you a chance to step outside of yourself and also step inside of everything. And that's the great part about story, is that you actually get to see problems from both the inside and the outside, which is something we can't do in real life. And then when you look to the solutions for those two through lines, you get even more understanding from it. You know, for Ripley, the solution to a problem of desire is ability, which is always kind of strange at first if you're new to Dramatica. You know, it's easy to see how, you know, if you're pursuing something, then if you avoid it, then you've solved it. It's like, oh, that makes sense. Or if you disbelieve something and then you have faith, oh, those seem like opposites. But our desire and ability opposites, and they actually really, really are. So she has this longing, this desire, you know, to have that fulfillment of, you know, feeling that motherly love. And it's not until she gains the ability to fight for herself and to, you know, when the Michael Biehn character is like actually teaching her to hold that gun, and like she's developing that ability to the place at the very end when she says, you know, get away from her. You know, she comes in that forklift thing. That's her just eschewing and getting rid of all that desire, all that narrative drive of the desire, all that problems, and just dealing strictly with ability. Well, it's like, you know what? I can't do anything about what happened in the past, but I can do something, and I can engage in ability. And that resolves her main character through line. And it also resolves the overall story because it gives her the ability to eject that, the queen out of the ship. And then they makes it possible, or makes it able for them to go home. So her change actually, you know, solves the problem in the overall story. And the same exact thing happens with Blade Runner 2049. He has this longing, this desire, all this stuff. And then when Joy points to him from the advertisement and calls him Joe, and he's like, ah, really? Like, she was just programmed to say that? Like, this is not real love? And then, of course, there's the reflection on it. And then he just does what he can do, which is choke the crap out of that other replicant and save Deckard and give him the ability to communicate with his daughter. Although I think there's some kind of inability there because he can't actually, he's not able to touch her because of the glass partition there, which I thought was great, beautiful. But he moved away from desire and he moved into ability, where it's just like, well, you know what? I don't care. I cannot just keep wanting and longing for this, but there is something that I can do. And then that, of course, goes along with the overall story through line where, you know, there's nothing more human than sacrificing yourself for a greater cause. You know, that's ability. It's like there's nothing more human than giving up your own personal desires in order to make it possible or make it able for others to engage in revolution and an uprising. So there you have Aliens and Blade Runner 2049. Both the main character and overall story through lines are the same thing. They're dealing with the same exact thematic structure underneath, completely different sets, completely different genre, not genres, but completely different tone. But deep down inside, they're dealing with the same thing. Now, those ones are really easy to see the similarities. The influence character and relationship story through lines are not as, the connections aren't, the obvious connections aren't there, but the underlying thematic structure of it still works in accordance with what's been set up in the influence character and the main character through lines. You know, the implied story points. So if you have those main character and overall story through lines, then the implication is the influence character will be dealing with mind, memory, suspicion, and perception. Which, if you want to get straight to it, you know, Harrison Ford puts up Elvis and he's seeing suspicious minds, which is like, that's suspicion, which is the influence character issue, and mind, which is the influence character through line. I just thought that was hilarious. I'm sure it's because they're huge Dramatica fans and they wanted to put that in there. Or they just knew naturally that was the best selection, you know, in regards, in context of what the narrative was dealing with. So both Joy and Deckard, they're coming from a point of view where it doesn't matter what's happening in reality. All that matters is what you know. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter what you say. I know what I know, and I can be anything you need me to be. And I'm coming from a place of perception. Now, Newt is not coming from the same sort of, is not illustrating perception the same way. She's looking at it from this scared, frightened child who thinks there's no way anybody can actually be there for me. And we're all going to die. You all are going to die. They come out mostly at night. You guys are all dead. There's nothing you can do about it. And she's so locked in her own perception because of the constant remembering of what, you know, her watching her family die, I'm sure all that stuff, that she doesn't suspect for one moment that somebody can actually be there for her. And of course, that influences and challenges Ripley the same way that Joy challenges Kay to finally give in to his ability. Newt is challenging and influencing Ripley to not give in to her ability, but to engage in her ability. So there you see they're different illustrations of it, but they are still coming from the same place. Now, when it comes to the relationship story, I feel like the relationship story through line in Blade Runner 2049 is much better. It's illustrated more fully. And the fact that they're trying to integrate into each other's lives and constantly adapting and changing to each other is the source of problems in their lives. In Aliens, it's there. The official analysis talks about the dreams and whether or not, you know, they'll be able to, you know, sleep and all that stuff. I think really the mother-daughter relationship where it's like, how can I be your mother and are you going to be my daughter? Like the same thing where it's like their essential natures, they're both set up to be mother-daughter. And it's not that they're constantly changing to adapt the other's point of view, but they are changing into this mother-daughter relationship, and there is this drive to adapt to the other's needs in order to fulfill that. So in effect, it is the same sort of conflict or the same sort of source of conflict in their relationship. It's just perhaps not as explored as fully as it is in Blade Runner. I mean, Blade Runner has all the great scenes of her employing the prostitute to kind of get closer to him. It's got him, you know, giving her freedom so that she can go out and feel the rain. And then, of course, she freezes. So there's a lot more meat to the relationship story in Blade Runner. But the same exact thematic construct is there in both Blade Runner 2049 and Aliens. So when you look at all four through lines, you look at that, you're looking at the same inequity from the four different perspectives, and it comes up with the singular approach that by engaging an ability, you're going to have success. You're going to be able to understand what happened to the colony and be able to communicate that back to Earth and Aliens. And then you're going to have the success in understanding, you know, what is going on with the replicant revolution and understanding, you know, what all this means, the fact that we can actually procreate and create, you know, we can be our own beings. And then, of course, it's a good thing for both the main characters in both Aliens and in Blade Runner. In Aliens, she has that daughter that she lost. You know, she jumps into her arms and I believe she even calls her mommy, right? And then in Blade Runner, he gets to die with the satisfaction, or actually the fulfillment, of the idea that he was actually human on his own terms. So that does it for this week's podcast. If you have any questions, please write to me at narrativefirst.com/contact. If you'd like to learn more about Dramatica, you can enroll in the Dramatica Mentorship Program, which is a program I've been running for 2 years now. And if you'd like to engage me and actually write a story with me, I would strongly suggest Deliberate Storytelling, where we actually sit down and we waste no time and we construct your story so you can get to writing. Have a great week of writing, and I'll see you next time.